You could call it fighting with fire. If generative AI is spurring a revolution in phishing and identity fraud, other forms of AI, like AI-driven biometrics, are taking up the challenge. With facial recognition or fingerprint sensors on nearly every smartphone, biometrics has finally gone from sci-fi to mainstream. There is power in new biometric applications to make life more convenient and secure, and yet, there is also an obligation to use it responsibly. So where is this headed, and what do business, government, and IT leaders need to know? Hi, I'm Ken Cadet, and this is the Entrust Cybersecurity Institute podcast. To delve into this new wave of AI-enabled biometrics, we are joined by two subject matter experts. The first is John Payne, Director of Government Relations at Entrust. Thanks for being here, John.
Hi, Ken. Thank you.
And I should note that just a few days before this recording, Entrust completed its acquisition of Onfido, a technology leader in AI-powered identity verification and truly expert in biometrics. Joining us is Alad Lloyd-Owen, Global Policy Director with Onfido. So welcome to Entrust, Alad, and to the podcast.
Thanks very much for having me, Ken. And yeah, it's great to have joined the Entrust family.
So, Alad, why don't we start with you? We talked about AI regulation on our podcast last month and noted that these regulations are getting increasing attention around the world. Why are biometrics such a flashpoint in AI regulatory discussions?
Well, I think biometrics are far and away the most sensitive data that we are processing, particularly within, you know, a commercial sense. And your biometrics are a credential that are irreplaceable if they are compromised. You know, we can't replace them as easily as we could a lost document. And so because they are part of who we are, it is essential that they are treated with the respect that comes with that. And in order to be able to build trust with consumers, in terms of how we are dealing with the management of those biometric systems, we need to build a relationship that is transparent and demonstrates our responsibility and our good practice in terms of how we handle and how we use those biometrics in order to provide efficient, effective, and modern services.
Absolutely. And John, we were talking before about how, like, you know, when you hear biometrics in the media, it seems like, you know, there's a lot of simplicity. There's a lot of, you know, sometimes even fear thrown out about biometrics. You know, we can't really talk about biometrics as one application, right? I mean, how should we think about it?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right, Ken. I think that it's incumbent on us in the industry to be kind of sober about it and be really specific about what's happening, different kinds of use cases for this technology. And it's not a single monolith called biometrics. There are lots of differences and nuances where it's possible to use this technology very responsibly, which of course is what we're hoping to do. It's also possible to misuse it. And I think, so I absolutely agree with what Alan said at the starting point. I think what I would add is, you know, for example, in the media, there's often a conflation with surveillance. Biometrics, I've read articles that literally said biometrics means surveillance, but it doesn't. And there's an awful lot of use cases, really kind of important, good new use cases for biometric technology that are making people's lives better, that has got precisely nothing to do with surveillance. For example, I'm crossing a border and I want to be able to verify to a government that I am the owner of my passport and nobody else can steal my identity because my face is tied to my passport, for example. That's a one-to-one match, right? And so there's a distinction here between a one-to-one face biometric match, for example, versus a one-to-many match, which is something that's much more common in criminal investigation use cases. And I think that kind of subtlety is rarely seen in the media coverage, and we probably need to do a little bit better at explaining these nuances.
Yeah, so Alan, what are some examples of some of the kinds of those one-to-one applications that John's talking about? Like how is it increasingly getting used in, you know, in government as well as, you know, in business, financial, other kinds of applications? And why is this becoming so important?
So on Fido, we do ID verification using biometrics. And verification is that one-to-one matching process. We're presented with a document and we're presented with an individual's biometrics, and we conduct an assessment that verifies whether that person is who they say they are. and we can provide that to assist our customers in onboarding their consumers or to facilitate work checks and as part of their regulatory compliance regimes as well, to make sure that they are doing the right KYC, know your customer checks to comply with anti-money laundering legislation, etc. And there are three key elements, I think, to the use of biometrics in this space. And the first is that verification point. That is the one-to-one match. And once we've been through that gateway, a credential exists and we can use that to authenticate an identity. So when you use your face to open your smartphone, it's a great example of using a confirmed biometric in order to authenticate that you are the legitimate user and to gain access. The third element then is identification, and that's that one-to-many piece. And that's a much more sensitive use case. I think one of the things that we look at in terms of our responsibility as a company using biometrics is appreciating that the tools that we have developed and the AI that we have developed to do those really effective verification one-to-one checks, they can also be used potentially for some of those potentially more intrusive use cases, such as identification. And that's why, again, that transparency is really important to demonstrate that we are practicing and utilizing those biometrics and conducting our business in a way that is not steering into some of those more intrusive use cases without the necessary protections and authorizations in place.
Makes sense. So it sounds like those kinds of applications that make things a lot easier, right? I mean, I've tried some of this and you can, identify yourself quickly and not have to go into a bank, for example, to do to open an account or something like that. It seems like this kind of thing is going to be more and more used, which of course raises the fear of fraud with this sort of thing, right? And we've heard a lot about deepfakes and things like that. Aled, I know Onfido did a study of what's happening on its own systems and put together an identity fraud report last year that cited a big increase in digital forgeries between 2021 and 2023. So we're seeing a lot more sophistication there. What do you see happening there? How do biometrics help or hinder the creation or detection of AI-generated deepfakes and other types of attacks?
So remote onboarding has been transformational in terms of allowing regulated entities to onboard their customers. But one of the challenges is that it has made it easier for fraudsters to be able to challenge the protections that are in place. Traditionally, if you wanted to open a bank account fraudulently, you would need to make up a really solid, authentic-looking document with your photograph in that and be able to present that face-to-face and get through an authorization process that way. Now, online, with the ubiquity of AI, this is becoming easier and easier. Actually, all you need to do is an injection attack. You might need to just simply insert your face on top of a picture of a legitimate document that you might have stolen or acquired through the dark web, etc. So there are ways around now some of those more sophisticated, those traditionally complicated routes to sort of stealing or forging an identity in order to gain access to a regulated service. And financial services are one of our biggest clients, and it's a perfectly relatable example, I'm sure, to a lot of listeners about the transformation from going into branch of a bank versus being able to do these processes online. What we've seen in Onfido is a 3,000% increase in the use of deepfakes alone over the last year. That's a huge, huge proliferation. And of course, it's the result of ubiquitous AI allowing for the proliferation of technology that allows users with, not particularly sophisticated technical skills to be able to generate a convincing forgery and to be able to deliver a convincing injection attack. So it makes it easier. That's the simple answer, I guess.
Right. So how do we use AI to fight that?
Well, this is the thing. So you've got an AI-created problem, but actually AI is a really important part of the solution too. It allows us to examine the data that's presented to us, and to look at an image, whether it's the document or whether it's the biometrics of the person who's presenting, and examine that in a level of detail that a human user could never achieve. And so it's an arms race, effectively, but it's one in which AI is not only the cause, but it's very much the solution too. And we have to stay one step ahead the whole time and keep thinking about more and more innovative ways of using that AI in order to be able to provide the most fraud deterrent service that we can to our clients.
John, we talked about deepfakes a little bit. 2024, there's a lot of elections going on in the US and the UK, many other places around the world. We've seen deepfakes already that are being used for misinformation purposes. How effective are we seeing biometric defenses against some of these kinds of spoofs?
Yeah, and you're exactly right. I think it's true to say, Ken, that more than half of the population of the world is voting this year. I think I believe I read that somewhere. So it's not just US and UK, but plenty of other places as well. And you're right, we are seeing deepfakes. We're also seeing them being spotted and being kind of flagged as such in the media quite a lot as well, which is a good thing. I think I agree absolutely with what Alec just said a moment ago, which is AI, the massive increase in the kind of the exponential growth and the smartness of AI technology is both the problem and the solution. So there's a kind of a race between governments and industry with the bad guys to keep on top of this. And I think I would just say, look, think about this. Biometrics has been with us forever, right? Because it's about your personal characteristics. And it's just that biometrics technology has come an awful long way. Not that many years ago, perhaps three decades ago, we were taking fingerprints by literally putting people's fingers in ink and rolling them on pieces of paper. And that was biometric technology not that many years ago. So things have come on an awful long way. So the things that Alad is talking about now, instant one-to-one matches with a face, instant ability to have trained machines to recognize, for example, one of the technologies that we use, both on Fido and Entrustio, are using is liveness technologies, which are very, very rapidly improving, in the last several years, as is face matching. So liveness being, is this a real person at the end of this, application on this photograph, on this video? Is this a real person versus some kind of spoof? Those technologies have absolutely grown exponentially in the last 4 or 5 years. We're doing things today that would be simply impossible in about 2017 or 2016, but are now commonly done both in governments and in the financial sector. So I think the important thing to say is the exponential growth in the accuracy of these technologies is absolutely breathtaking. But that means that we're in a race with the bad guys who are looking. With folks with a nefarious intention are also trying to use these things for nefarious purposes, and our job is to stay on top of them.
If I can come in there as well, I think Elfrida gave evidence on this to Parliament a couple of weeks ago, and one of the key things that we sort of picked up on in our session was it's very difficult to proportionately regulate the use of deepfakes, particularly in, for example, the election space. If you're spoofing a political candidate to make a joke of them, that's one thing. But if you're doing it for a more nefarious purpose, well, that's another, and that has potentials to undermine democracy. So what do you do? Do you regulate to ban the use of deepfakes completely? Because that's going to capture a lot of those trivial use cases. And it's also going to stop companies like Onfido generating our own synthetic data to help deter fraud. Or do you have to think about broader and more innovative solutions? And there is a fine line, I think. I think this really, actually, this use case really drives home the challenge in terms of regulation between what is a proportionate response and what is required in order to simply appreciate that actually there are a number of freedoms that are generally being exercised, albeit with new and potentially alarming technology.
So you're basically saying that you need to sort of differentiate between intent to defraud or intent to mislead and, let's say, art, right? You know, or humor or parody, which is definitely a tough one. Let's talk a little bit about regulation and guardrails. You talked a little bit about some of the unintended consequences. If you're a business leader, or you know, if you're in government, where do you think we should be putting up guardrails so that we're getting the most advantage to make life more easy and more convenient and more secure, you know, rather than, you know, causing some of the things that are that you know, we shouldn't be and shouldn't have to deal with and shouldn't have to be afraid of?
I think from a government point of view, Ken, when we're talking about government services, one of the key things I think that the public is concerned about is what you might call robot decisions, right? Are robots going to, this is the kind of, if I might put it in a tabloid kind of language, are robots going to make decisions, significant decisions about my life in a way that I don't have any kind of control or visibility over? And I think there's a principle in there. Whether or not this is regulatable is a different question, but I think there's a principle for responsible use of biometrics which goes like this. It's reasonable, I think, and fair for governments to want to give their human decision makers better and richer data in order to make those decisions, right? So I spent most of my government life doing border control, immigration kind of work, and the more information you could give, rich information you could give to the human decision maker, can only be a good thing. The problem is, I think, is if we turn our brains off and we say, well, this machine can make automatic decisions for me, and therefore I don't have to have any kind of person, human kind of oversight of what's going on, then I think you get, understandably, you get, public will get very concerned about that. And I think that's the kind of, that's not the only answer to your question, but I think it's one of them.
I agree with that. I think that's a really sort of strong lead off. I think fundamentally, what regulation needs to do is to accept that AI is a tool, that biometrics are a tool, and it's how you use that tool that fundamentally is where trust, where good practice, and where bad practice will come into play. And therefore, regulation needs to, first of all, prevent the bad use cases from developing and ensure that there is accountability. But it also needs to build trust and transparency with consumers. And that's multi-layered. That's through things like things that the EU AI Act, for example, has brought forward, which is to demonstrate transparency in decision making, which is also to publish annual reports and to submit to member state regulators, etc., to ensure that the technologies are overseen properly. And that's really important, as is having humans in the loop, which is, again, another provision within the EU AI Act. It provides a level of reassurance, ultimately, in terms of flawed technology, which is always a risk. You know, can we provide consumers with the satisfaction that at some level there will be a human involved in their decisions who will be responsible for the ultimate decision that's made? And so regulation has to be sensitive in this case, I think, to more than the usual in terms of that responsibility to sort of build trust between consumers and users and deployers of these systems.
There's another principle in there as well about consent and alternatives, right, is an important, and Alan touched on consent. So not just that the public is aware that AI is being used in some way, but that also that where it's appropriate, that there is the possibility of giving consent, and they're at least they're aware that there is an opportunity to do to go through that process in a different way. Now, it might be that whatever it is that they're doing, whether they're crossing a border or paying their taxes or whatever it is, it might very well be that those alternatives are a lot less convenient, or rather more old-fashioned, rather more paper-based, whatever it is. But at least what we find anyway in a lot of work that we do is that those alternatives are still being made available by governments, that the citizen gets the opportunity to make a choice about whether they want to take that one route or the other. And I think that's another important principle in terms of public confidence that these systems can be used responsibly.
How do you feel like this translates over to businesses as well? So if, you know, banks are increasingly using this, right? Airlines, et cetera. Are there principles or guidelines that, you know, every, you know, any business ought to be considering?
There's a really interesting example in the UK. So the Financial Conduct Authority submits UK financial institutions to a consumer duty. So they are judged on the outcome for the consumer in terms of the majority of their practices. So while there's a very sort of heavy regulated know your customer process through which, for example, the Onfido system is used to verify a customer and then various checks take place on them sort of outside of our purview, but within the financial institution, the focus must always be on what does this mean for the consumer and are they getting a fair deal? And that's not a bad place to start from. Insofar as, for example, if there is a problem with the Onfido verification, we say that there's not a, we make a recommendation that there's not a good enough match between the document and the person. What's the solution there? Well, probably, as things currently stand, a bank is going to need to maintain a branch because someone's alternative to using the app is to go into branch, present their face and present their document and be verified in that way. So by focusing on those consumer outcomes, I think a lot of these legacy systems will continue. But also look at the use of biometrics in terms of cash payments. So Apple Pay, for example, is, you know, and others are available. The use of automated payments that use biometric authentication feels like something that has spiraled significantly over the last sort of 3 to 5 years. And yet, in Europe, for example, one of the most advanced technologically, in consumer terms, financial markets in the world, cash remains king. 60% use at the point of sale in the majority of member states. That's enormous. So I think that there is also a consideration that although AI and the use of these more sophisticated biometric systems exist, consumers will continue to enjoy and probably to some extent insist on having manual methods as a fallback and in many cases as their principal means of engaging with various entities and with various commercial enterprises.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. I've seen some similar studies where like people are very comfortable with use of biometrics for various, you know, for various use cases like this. And very comfortable with that. And at the same time, they want to have that diversity of ways to pay or diversity of ways to identify themselves as well. It'll be interesting to see how that how generational differences might play out in that area. Considering all that, there's also been a lot of talk about do these systems work well? Is there bias in the system toward certain outcomes or certain populations in terms of how it identifies people? Where are we on that? How are systems addressing that? You know, and are there guardrails or regulations that are developing around those kinds of considerations as well?
Yeah, I mean, this is a big one, Ken, that we've talked about for years, right? The question of, and I think this is a good example of where the media coverage does not help the public understanding in terms of the responsible use of biometrics. And by that, I mean, the word bias itself is not terribly helpful because it's got a couple of different meanings. One of them is that it's a bad human trait, but it's also a lack of accuracy in a system. And the word bias means both those things. And I think the media, it conflates them deliberately and it's not helpful. So I would prefer, I always prefer to use what NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, here in the US Department of Commerce, is, I think, the leading authority on this kind of, on biometric accuracy in the world. I don't think that's a controversial statement. And they call this demographic effects. And I think they wrote in a really excellent report 2 or 3 years ago called Demographic Effects, which I think is the authoritative source of this question. And really what it's about, it says there's a number of ways in which these systems can potentially have slightly different outcomes for certain demographic groups than others. And it's incumbent on us as the, you know, in the industry to drive that out, to get that to the point of being almost nil. And that those differences, those demographic effects, are rapidly becoming smaller and smaller and smaller as the that the technology improves, but we can't pretend it's not there. I don't want to do that. But I do think that talking in very general ways about something like bias is deeply unhelpful in terms of public understanding. And I'll just touch on one of the points that is made in that NIST report. There's lots to it, but one of them is on the business of diverse data sets, right? That, you know, what we're talking about here is machine learning. If you teach, you know, the world is an extremely diverse place, and if you train your AI on a very limited, non-diverse data set, and then you go out into the real world and expect it to work accurately, you're going to be disappointed. And so that's the kind of thing that's happening. It's not deliberate bias against any demographic group. It's simply a slightly naive way of training your algorithms. And we know that now, and it's incumbent on us to do better.
I think that's absolutely right. And I'm going to now agree with you and then continue to use the word bias, possibly incorrectly. But I think that's absolutely right. It's definitely something that's been captured in a number of the proposed AI regulations. And of course, it's in the EU AI Act as well. President Biden's executive order last November on AI, actually contained a very heavy focus on civil rights obligations and bias elimination. And I think that's really important. But I think John is absolutely right as well in terms of the fact that it's confusing things slightly. So, you know, bias in a system could also mean that we start refusing mortgages to people with beards because, for whatever reason, that is having an impact on the system because there is some quirk within the training data. One of the things that's really important, I think, is, again, it comes from that trust and transparency point, is that companies like Onfido that are using biometrics as part of their solutions are able to test and work to eliminate this bias. And sometimes that means working with diverse data sets, and sometimes that also means generating synthetic data too, and using that to make sure that testing can take place across a very broad range of different categorizations in order to eliminate all bias from the system. But again, I think absolutely the key point that John has made is really interesting and is around the fact that actually bias is not synonymous with prejudice within a system, but is in fact, is a technical quirk that has certainly significant impacts for certain groups, but, you know, is also a wider issue and needs to be legislated and regulated accordingly and is a vital part of building trust.
Yeah, thanks, Alan. I'm glad you agree on this, because this is a slightly controversial point, but I think it's an important one which we're getting wrong a little bit out in the public sphere, Ken. And there's a technical term for it, which is, if I may attempt a big word, anthropomorphism. And anthropomorphism is, right, means assigning human characteristics to something that's not human. And in this case, that's the problem that I've got. Not that there isn't a proper use of, statistically, of the word bias, there is. But if you pick up a tabloid newspaper and you say this system is biased, what does the man in the street or the woman in the street take from that headline, from that language? It's not the technical term for the word bias. What they take from that language is that somehow the system is biased in the more common sense against certain demographic groups. That's simply not the case, and it's certainly not anybody's intention. And I think it's, in terms of those of us in the industry, I think we have to do a better job at explaining what we're doing and why we're doing it.
Yeah, and I think it comes down to the people, as you guys talked about before, right? I mean, that's why you want lots of different people represented in the decisions on how to train an AI, right?
Well, let's leave it there. I'm really appreciative of the thoughtfulness of the people who are, you know, in many ways, taking the lead on some of these applications in terms of how identity verification using AI and biometrics is, being applied in, you know, places like in governments and government services and in business. So let's just, I'll put out one question just to wrap up. For people, you know, people like us driving responsible development of biometrics and AI, what should be our obligations? What should be our guiding principles? Alan, let's start with you.
The key thing for me, it must be building trust through transparency and explainability, and that's critical. Not being afraid effectively to demonstrate insofar as is possible, that we are aware of the risks and we do what we can to mitigate those, and that we have in mind that that consumer outcome, that we want people to have trust in these systems, and most importantly, trust that is well placed.
John?
Yeah, I mean, I agree all that, as with all of that. And I think I would add, the principle, really, the way that we often talk about it, Ken, is privacy by design, is building in privacy for the citizens who use our systems from the ground up, right? Which means things like, for example, what information do we need for this particular use case? We only take the information that's needed. We only use it for its specified purpose. We get rid of the data when we don't need it anymore. We communicate to the member of the citizen or the user what we're doing and when we're doing it, how long we're keeping the data, when we're getting rid of it, whether it's being kept by the government end user or another financial end user, all of those kind of things. It's absolutely doable. This privacy by design is kind of the simplest way of describing that. It's completely doable. We just have to make sure that we build our systems that way from the start.
Absolutely. Well, thank you both. Alan, thank you. John, thank you. We're going to leave it there for now. Appreciate you sharing your experience and insights in this area. I think it's been a really interesting conversation. And thank you all for listening. Our podcast was produced by Stephen Damone. If you like what you hear, I do encourage you to rate and review this podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And of course, we'd love to hear from you. You can email your opinions and ideas to cybersecurityinstitute@ntrust.com. Till next time, thank you.